Let's wait till the courtroom clears.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Carter, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Adam Carter of the Employment Law Group on behalf of Mary Kate Breeden. I'll start with proximate cause and intervening cause. Even an amateur gardener like myself would know that if you cut a limb of a tree three quarters of the way, the limb could collapse of its own weight, it could break off in the next storm, or it could die its inevitable death for lack of nutrients. And that's exactly what happened here. Breeden's supervisors intended to get rid of her, but it took some time for that damage to materialize. And here, let's not forget, there is a jury verdict. Ever since Milwaukee versus St. Paul Railway in 1896, the jury decides proximate cause. And the standard in this circuit is Hicks and Boudou. And to take away a jury verdict, it has to be absolutely clear. That's the standard. And here there's more than sufficient evidence of proximate causation. Page 43 of Novartis.
So I understand your theory. The theory is that the 2005 realignment is connected to the 2008 termination?
Correct, and let me tell you why. On page 43 of Novartis's brief, they say there are two reasons why she's terminated: fewer accounts and fewer prescriptions. And that is the reason why she's terminated in 2008. What happened in 2000?
They did another reassessment, I guess, or another consultant in 2007, another in 2008, and so they have to pick one of two people. And they had some written guidelines, I guess, about how to do that, right? And the other person had more prescriptions and accounts.
That's right. And but for the retaliation, she would have had more prescriptions and more accounts. And we know from the recent decision in Staub that just a new decision maker at the same company doesn't change the matter. How can it be said that the injury that was not proximate when the same reasons were given that she was complaining about? Fewer accounts, fewer prescriptions. She knew she was on the chopping block. We know from the restatement of torts, section 433, mere lapse of time is not sufficient to prevent it from being the legal cause. That's in Hicks also. And it's not disputed that Novartis created the condition of the harm. If somebody spills gasoline all over a house but doesn't ignite it, they've created the condition of the harm just as much as the person who ignites it. Wasn't Novartis under a duty to protect Ms. Breeden from the harm that did in fact occur? The jury found that there was retaliation. She was the victim of retaliation, and those effects were never cured. The consistent link, the constant link, was her supervisor, Tom Harper. Tom Harper's the one who said, "We'll make you whole. I'll make you whole." And then when she comes back from her FMLA qualifying leave, no.
She has the same title, the same benefits, the same base salary, and she performs better in the sense of her ranking and makes more in bonuses after she comes back from the leave. Correct?
Which makes her more expensive for doing less work and moving less product. It makes her even more vulnerable.
Going back to what you said before, when she came back, she had the same objective characteristics of the job in the sense of title, pay, base pay, benefits, and actually had the opportunity to make more than she did before, which she took advantage of and did.
That's all true, and that is all true. But she, under that's their pay scheme where she can do more with more opportunity. But what she has in terms of opportunity is really nothing. She has very little accounts. We know that from the testimony of Ruth Ann Sneath. She didn't even call on these accounts after these were assigned to her. She had very little. This went from having a full-time job to having a part-time job. Yes, you can say same pay, same benefits, all of those things. And that is true. But in terms of her worth, in terms of her effort, in terms of the responsibility, The statute and the regulation is very clear. It has to be a virtually identical job, and it has to be And it wasn't. And that gets us to the interference claim. I'll get to that in a moment.
She had the exact same job after she came back that she had when she left.
She had...
The realignment was done before she left on maternity leave.
Yes, this is true. But even the district court didn't do that.
I think that may be a mistake.
Well, it's not for this reason, and that is, I pointed this out in my brief, any clever employer would do that for any woman who was pregnant. She announces she's pregnant.
There was another pregnant woman, Dilger, and her announcement came at the same time, and she didn't get her territory realigned. So where's the discrimination based on the maternity leave?
The jury found that. The jury found discrimination. We have that finding here, and the evidence was overwhelming for this 12-person jury that she was, in fact, the victim of retaliation, that the comments were made, you're not coming back, we're giving it to the other woman, she's single. Those kinds of comments were very clear to the jury. My point, though, on proximate cause is, and we know what an intervening cause is from Exxon and those sorts of cases recently cited in Staub, that was the case of the oil tanker that came loose of its mooring, and then the ship captain didn't plot its course, and that was an intervening cause. Here we have the same company doing the same thing that it has been doing, which is to become a nimble sales organization. They realign from time to time, and keep in mind, Judge Kavanaugh, this goes to your question. When she was, when the realignment happened in 2008, It was, yes, a new management team, but they were still relying on the same records that had been the made by the folks who had retaliated against her. Her protected activity was in there, and the jury found there was a materially adverse action.
You said that she was terminated because she had fewer accounts and wrote fewer prescriptions, and that was true. But the metric that was used to do that had apparently developed out of some other process that the company was going through, and it was simply applied to her. It wasn't created when they did the realignment. Is that correct?
Not exactly right. It's a little more nuanced than that. The yes, they have. They're a drug company, and they have people who sell drugs all across the country. So they've established metrics on how to combine territories. That is true, but that's not why she loses her job. She loses her job because they said, we're going to combine these two territories and we're going to make a new one. And Mr. Harper, her boss at the time, doesn't even interview her for the job, doesn't even consider her. She's now moved up the rankings to seventh. She doesn't get an interview, and the testimony at trial was that she would have moved to Indiana and taken that job. So that's why she was terminated. Harper is the constant link. The jury heard all of this information, and the jury is the one that gets to decide proximate cause. Jesus Leal, the new consultants, that's all a smokescreen for what they do ordinarily, which is we want to have an effective sales organization. And she knew all along that she
was
vulnerable.
A smokescreen?
I say a smokescreen in the sense that the jury heard all that. The jury heard that there was Mr. Leal and that there was this Powell Associates and that they were going to reconfigure the territories. They heard all that, and they didn't buy it. They bought that Mr. Harper was the one who said, I'll make you whole, and didn't. And that was the materially adverse action. I'd like to just move briefly to equitable relief, independent. Completely independent of whether there's damages that are proximate or not. There is another remedy under the FMLA. And when there's a finding, as there was here, this jury verdict is undisturbed on that point, there is a requirement that appropriate equitable relief be given. That's at 2617A1B of the statute. And it's clean and it's simple and it has nothing to do with causation or the need for economic damages. This case, at a minimum, should be remanded to the district court for an award of appropriate equitable relief. And then finally, on interference, the question is, are these two jobs virtually identical? That is a jury question. And the judge, and we know that Novartis has admitted that the two positions were not equivalent because Mr. Harper said, we'll make you whole. The jury found that to be a true statement. Why would you need to make someone whole if the jobs were not equivalent and the level of effort was not the same? I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. Goldberg.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me. May it please the court, my name is Rachel Goldberg. I represent the Secretary of Labor. The FMLA permits employees to take job-protected unpaid leave, and it prohibits an employer from retaliating against an employee for having exercised those rights. And that prohibition comes out of Section 2615A1 of the statute, which prohibits an employer from interfering with or restraining an employee's exercise or attempted to exercise her FMLA rights. Congress very clearly gave the Department of Labor legislative rulemaking authority, and the department has utilized that through notice and comment regulation, through that notice and comment regulation has interpreted the interference that is prohibited in Section 2615A1 to encompass retaliation for exercising FMLA rights. That interpretation is a reasonable one, which is entitled to deference under Chevron. The FMLA, the provision A1 is ambiguous as to what exactly interference means. Congress didn't define it, and the department has reasonably defined it to include retaliation for exercising FMLA rights. Every court that has looked at the FMLA has concluded that there has to be a right against retaliation for exercising one's FMLA rights, and the department has opined.
Some have done that under A1 and some under A2.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. And then the department has opined in its most recent regulations, at least rather clarified in its most recent regulations, that is most appropriately or most naturally falls within A1. And so once you are in A1, then the question is a mixed motive analysis proper given the language in A1? And given the legislative rule that the department promulgated at 825.220, in which the department indicated that taking FMLA leave cannot be considered as a negative factor in an employment decision. And Gross does not require otherwise. While Gross instructs us that we need to start with the statutory language, here we do start with the statutory language of Section A1. It's ambiguous, and we have clear legislative rulemaking authority, so the department's regulation is certainly relevant to the analysis of whether a mixed motive analysis is appropriate. The language in A1 is broadly protective, similar to the language that this court found broadly protective in the Ford decision. And for similar reasons, that broadly protective language is consistent with a mixed motive theory of liability. And we believe that this court, should the court reach this issue, that a burden shifting is appropriate here. A1, unlike the ADEA, where Gross said what was silent on this issue, the AD, Section A1 is not silent. It is ambiguous, as I have mentioned. And the department has, through its notice and comment regulation, made clear that a mixed motive analysis is proper.
I guess I don't understand that. Isn't it silent on this particular issue?
It does not answer the particular issue. Explicitly say that retaliation for exercising one's FMLA rights is prohibited. So I think it's clearly ambiguous as to that right, and that right surely has to be found in the statute, and A1 is the most natural location. So once you get into A1 in that way.
Concluding what you just said doesn't necessarily lead you to the further conclusion that you have to have a mixed motive theory.
No. I think that's correct. It doesn't necessarily lead there, but the next step in the analysis is whether a mixed motive analysis is consistent with the language of A1. Given the department's rulemaking authority and our opinion that a mixed motive analysis is proper, it makes sense then to get to the regulation and view that as persuasive and due deference under Chevron. If there are no further questions, the Secretary asks this court to find that a mixed motive jury instruction is proper in an FMLA retaliation case. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Stetson?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Kate Stetson for Novartis. Because Ms. Goldberg's argument is directed to the conditional cross-appeal, with the court's indulgence, I'd like to step back and address Mr. Carter's argument in the first instance, and then I'd be happy to discuss the cross-appeal as well. And I want to start with the equitable relief argument, because I think this argument evidences a core misapprehension about what the district court did and did not do in its JNOV ruling. The district court did not merely find that Novartis's action didn't cause any damages, money damages, to Ms. Breeden. He concluded, and this is at Joint Appendix 1025, that the termination, her 2008 harm, had not been caused by the 2005 realignment. That's exactly what he says. And once that actual decision has been put into full relief, I think it's quite clear that there's no basis for an award of equitable relief here, any more than there was a basis for the jury's award of money damages.
Because
there's no violation. And under Ragsdale and under Section 2617, which is the relief provision of the Family and Medical Leave Act, you need to have actual harm, whether that harm be, as the statute says, a loss of compensation or benefits, or some other monetary loss that's a direct result of the violation, or some loss in employment status that's caused by the violation. That's what the statute says. And what Judge Robertson concluded here was that the 2005 realignment and the failure to make whole, which throughout this case, plaintiff's counsel insisted was the adverse action, that's where they located that action, did not cause the termination 3 years later. And I think, Judge Kavanaugh, that gets to your question that we led off with in the proximate cause analysis. The district court, I think, understood throughout that there was, as he put it at one point, a fundamental causation proof problem in this case. But he took, I think, a very conservative approach. He let the entire issue play out. He sent it to a jury. And when the jury came back with its verdict, and when Novartis moved for judgment notwithstanding that verdict on this causation ground, what the court pointed to was this fact that the 2005 adverse action and the 2008 harm seriously complicated, as he put it at Joint Appendix 1026, the causation analysis. And what he concluded was that all of the intervening events, not just new management, but the new rule that Your Honors pointed out, the new outside consultant, the passage of time, had essentially not just provided insufficient evidence for the jury's verdict, which was all that Judge Robertson needed to conclude to grant JNOV. He actually found that, if anything, the evidence supported the exact opposite finding, that there was no causal link between 2005 and 2008.
I think Mr. Carter says that the 2005 realignment was due to her leave. She got different assignments areas after, didn't have Maryland and Hopkins after 2005 realignment. And therefore, when 2008 rolls around, she has fewer accounts. And therefore, she doesn't get the job as compared to, I think it's Snyth, the other person who got the job. Can you respond to that?
Well, sure. I mean, this is Ms. Breeden's inexorability theory, that essentially, because of the realignment in 2005, it was inexorable or inevitable that 3 years later, you know, a different manager applying a new rule on the advice of an outside consultant after the creation of a new territory and under conditions where they weren't able to hire a new person, but they had to realign their current personnel in order to make room for this new territory, that all of those things were inevitable because she was reassigned hospitals in 2005. The problem with that, as Judge Robertson pointed out, is that under the proximate cause analysis, under either perspective. If you look at it through the ex ante lens, or you look at it, or you look at it from the ex post lens, under neither of those analyses does the notion hold up that her termination was inevitable. It could not have been foreseen. There was insufficient evidence legally to foresee in 2005 that she would be terminated in 2008 because of this realignment. Similarly, in 2008, it was not a direct result of her realignment 3 years earlier that caused her termination. It was a new management, a new rule, a new consultant, a new created position, and a position that didn't admit to hiring one more person. It required a relocation of somebody. All of those sort of aggregated factors contributed to the judges.
So maybe it wasn't inevitable in 2005, but suppose, just hypothetically, that you knew that she was given fewer areas, fewer hospitals, even apart from the facts of this case. Just suppose her accounts were contracted substantially because of her leave. Okay, and that doesn't mean inevitably she'll lose her job, but when it comes time for the reorg 3 years later and they have to downsize, she has fewer things to bring to the table, fewer accounts, fewer prescriptions because of what happened back in 2005. Is that not a viable theory?
I don't think it's a viable theory, Judge Kavanaugh, for among other reasons, something that I believe you pointed out to Mr. Carter, which is she performed, if anything, better upon return from her leave than before. She was ranked higher as a sales associate. Her numbers her pay was better, her bonus was better.
She might have maxed out her opportunities, but her opportunities, even as maxed out, at least Mr. Carter's theory is, still were lower than they otherwise would have been had she not suffered the reassignment based on her leave in 2005. And when it came time then to compare her to someone else in 2008, she didn't match up.
Yes, but I think that blinks a little bit too quickly the rigor of the proximate cause analysis that's required here. What Judge Robertson held, and interestingly, Mr. Carter doesn't appear to contest this in his brief. He suggests that there's been some sort of sea change between the jury instructions and Judge Robertson's opinion, but there is none. In fact, if you look at the statute, Section 2617, if you look at the jury instructions, and if you look at when you look at the opinion, what you'll see is that Judge Robertson elaborated on what no one disputes is the fundamental proximate cause requirement in an FMLA case. Was this foreseeable in 2005 that she would be fired? No. Was it the direct result of the realignment that she was fired? No. It was the direct result of a host of intervening factors. And I would point out that I think to some extent Breeden's counsel recognizes this because the emphasis on Mr. Harper, what you heard Mr. Carter refer to as the sole link of continuity between 2005 and 2008, has been much more vocal in this appeal than below. And the reason, I think, is because even Ms. Breeden's counsel recognizes that there needs to be some kind of continuing cause between 2005 and 2008. The problem with Mr. Harper, as we point out in our brief, is that he was neither involved in the realignment decision in 2005, nor was he involved in Ms. Breeden's termination decision in 2008. That particular manager, that person, is not any kind of a causal link, despite Ms. Breeden's heavy emphasis on it in the briefing. Let me turn briefly, if I may, to the summary judgment issue and the equivalent question. Judge Kavanaugh.
Before you start, let me just follow up on one thing. Is Barr the one who actually, when Harper says, let's get Barr on the phone or whatever, is he the one who says you're terminated? Or
Barr is the one who terminated.
And he's human resources.
Yes, that's correct. On equivalence, I think it's useful on this particular issue. First, you're quite right, Judge Kavanaugh, same title, same benefits, same pay, same bonus opportunities, if not more. The question on equivalence boils down to essentially what that loss is of which Ms. Breeden speaks. And it's a loss that she described on her summary judgment papers as a loss of prestige. She lost the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins. She gained the University of Virginia and NIH, among others. But because she felt that those territories weren't as good prospects, she felt that there was a certain amount of what she called loss of visibility within the company. But if you look at the cases to which she compares herself, I think there is a very significant distinction between the cases that she cites and her own. And I'll run down the list. Brenizon, which is cited in her reply, before this person took FMLA leave, he was a process analyst. Afterward, he was on the factory production line. Before Ms. Cooper, cited in the opening brief, took FMLA leave, she was a locomotive engineer. When she returned, she was a receptionist. Before Mr. Duarte, cited in the opening brief, took his leave, he was a primary design consultant. When he came back, he was an assistant. The list continues. If you look at all of those cases, of course, there is at least a jury question as to whether or not the position that that particular plaintiff occupied when he or she returned looked the same, was equivalent to the position that that person occupied before. Here, Judge Henderson, as you pointed out, to be perfectly fair to the district court, I think, took a very expansive view of the timing of the realignment vis-a-vis Ms. Breeden's leave. It so happens that the position that she returned to was precisely the position that she left when she took her leave. But even if we back up the lens a little bit and we look at December of 2004, what you find is that she left for her leave and she was a transplant sales specialist. She returned as a transplant sales specialist. She was assigned to a number of hospitals to sell transplant drugs. She was subsequently assigned to a number of hospitals to sell transplant drugs. Those jobs are perfectly equivalent, and the supposed loss of prestige is exactly the kind of intangible element that these regulations say is not a proper consideration.
Am I right about this Dilger? Did she announce at the same time, that is late fall, early winter of 2004, that she was going on maternity leave as well, but her territory was not changed?
Your Honor, I have to conclude that she must have announced at the same time, because if I'm remembering the record evidence correctly, there is a PowerPoint slide that Ms. Breeden made something of in the trial court to the effect of, you know, here's how we will be covering Kate Breeden's leave while she's out. And there was another person who I think is the one to whom you're referring who was also taking leave from a different district at the same time. So I think the timing was just about equivalent.
And there's a declaration somewhere that the second one, Dilger, did not have her territory changed, I think. Am I right about that?
That I would need to go back and refer to the record, yes. If there are no questions on the affirmative appeal, I'm happy to turn to the cross appeal. The issue on the cross appeal is what Gross requires. And I think it's clear from Gross, it's clear from subsequent circuits' interpretations of Gross. The Seventh Circuit has done the most work with Gross, I think, after it issued, that Gross requires an affirmative statement in the text of the statute if the usual, what the Gross court called the default burden, is to be changed. There is no such requirement on the face of A1. And by talking about A1, I should say, I'm conceding for purposes of this argument that that's even the proper place to locate the retaliation claim. Every single court, except for the First Circuit in a footnote, has suggested that Section A2 is the place to locate the retaliation claim. After all, A2 looks exactly like the almost precisely same worded retaliation provision of the ADA. So let's assume for this discussion, though, that A1 is an appropriate place to locate the retaliation claim. The fundamental problem that the Department of Labor and Ms. Breeden have is that after Gross, there needs to be an express statement of Congress's intent to reallocate the burdens of proof on the face of the statute. Chevron doesn't come into play. As this court has recognized time and again, starting from, if not before, the en banc decision in the Railway Labor Executive Association case back in 1994, the fact that a statute is ambiguous doesn't automatically trigger the Chevron analysis. What you need in order to look to an agency, in order to defer to an agency, is a gap and an implicit or explicit delegation of authority to the agency to solve that gap. You have both problems with both of those issues here. The first is there's no gap. The Supreme Court has said in Gross, and before that in Schaefer versus Wiest, that the default rule is that the plaintiff bears the but-for burden of proof in these circumstances. So there's no gap. But even if there were a gap, what you also need to find is some delegation of authority to the agency. The agency doesn't have authority to reallocate the burden of proof in a case like this. There's no implicit delegation of authority in a situation where the Supreme Court has said, this is what the default rule is unless Congress tells us otherwise. If there are no further questions on that.
If I understand what the agency is arguing here, by focusing on A1, they're saying, well, that's very broad language. If we looked at A2, you know, the operative language would be for opposing, which is fairly narrow. But if you only look at A1, there isn't any language there that tells you how you do it.
Right? Well, I think that's certainly why they want to look to A1, Judge Brown. Because if, I think even the Department of Labor recognizes that if the retaliation cause of action is located in A2, Gross dictates that they surely lose. But the problem with A1 is that you run into the same requirement in Gross, which is that Congress needs to have expressly dictated on the face of the statute that something other than the usual default burden applies. That's why Gross was making the comparison between Title VII's motivating factor language and, in that case, the because of language that was present in Gross. Here you have a situation where there is no express requirement on the face of A1 that anything other than the default rule applies when it comes to assigning the burden of proof and the weight of the burden of proof to the plaintiff. That's the fundamental problem with the cross appeal.
All right.
There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carter, how much time does he have?
Mr. Carter,
all right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. Just quickly on the equitable relief, it's an error to say that the material adverse action is the same thing as the requirement for damages. They're not. Under Burlington Northern, the standard is, you know, what may well dissuade someone from taking the leave. And so those are not equivalent. The jury makes the finding that there is a materially adverse action. That's enough for equitable relief to attach. There was a discussion by Ms. Stetson about there being a new rule. There's really not a new rule. The rule is the rule of business, to be efficient, have a sales organization that's nimble and efficient. That's nothing new. Novartis's TBU had been reorganized 3 times to be efficient and move people around and put people together.
I think the larger point is that it wasn't foreseeable in 2005 that there was going to be this specific downsizing or combination in 2008 that would lead to the plaintiff having a one-on-one competition in essence against someone else. That was just not foreseeable in 2005.
Your Honor, with all respect, I think that it is always foreseeable for a business to act efficiently and to want a sales organization that is efficient and nimble and that is foreseeable. They will reorganize someone out of a job if they're sitting at home and they only have a few accounts and they don't have much work to do. I think it's entirely foreseeable that a company will, who's paying that person a lot to move a little product, that they are going to...
What's strange about that is she has all these opportunities after 2005 to move up the ranks from 25th to 14th to 7th or whatever it was.
But only in the most obscure way of their rankings. It has nothing to do with the corporate spotlight.
But it also translated into something not obscure, money. She made more.
A little bit, but again, that hurt her. It made her more expensive for the amount of product she was moving, and she complained about that. She knew that she was going to be hurt later on down the ride, and that's why she complained. I notice I'm out of time. I just want to make one more point, if I could, please, and that was when they merged the two together, they don't eliminate her job. Yes, her territory is eliminated, but she's not terminated yet. It's when Harper decides that he's not going to offer her or interview her for the Indiana job, that's when she no longer has a job. He's got a job for her, but he doesn't offer it to her. The jury heard that. The jury is entitled to deference on that.
I want to ask you just one factual question. You may not know the answer. NIH is a tier two, right? Where is their transplant work done?
There really isn't. That was the other thing. The company thought that NIH was this big possibility because of the importance of the work that's being done there, but there were no real, there was no product being moved up there. It was a non-account. And the same thing goes, my opponent mentioned UVA. UVA was a closed door. Yes, Ms. Breeden was able to turn that around with her great skill later on. In fact, it's an irony of this case that she got the UVA win right before they terminated her, just a few days before. So the point, though, is that the counts that they say were the good ones and left in her territory, they really weren't. And Ms. Sneath's testimony was she didn't even bother to call on any of these accounts once she was given them. Her main bread and butter was Duke and UNC, and, of course, Breeden's bread and butter was Hopkins and Maryland. That's where the transplants are being done.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to put something on the record from the earliest case, and that is I neglected to thank Mr. Lekar, who was appointed by the court, for his very able representation of the defendant, Lorries, and I will write him a letter to that effect, but I want it on the record.
Stand, please. This honorable court is now adjourned.